The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled How to Find and Keep Your Soulmate, is dedicated to the memory and the Ilui Nishmot Yom Tov ben Avraham, Shmuel ben Yom Tov, Liza bat Shmuel, and Regina bat Yom Tov, Alehem Ashalom of blessed memory.
For someone single and eligible, getting married to the right person is likely to be a top priority in life. It is also a top priority for God Himself. According to the Midrash, in Bereishis Rabbah, Perek Samaches, chapter 68, God is constantly involved in making shiduchim, in making matches. In fact, the Midrash relates that a Roman matron, the owner of thousands of male and female slaves, challenged the wisdom of the Midrash and claimed that she could do as good a job as God in making lasting marriages. Thereupon, she randomly matched a male slave to a female slave, creating thousands of marriages in one clean swoop. It's not just the Reverend Moon. The next morning, to her dismay, she found her slaves with split skulls, gouged out eyes, and broken legs, the result of a single night of marital strife. She then admitted that being a successful shadchan, a successful matchmaker, was no mean feat, and it needed all the divine assistance that it could get. If there were difficulties attached to the process of finding and keeping a mate in years gone by, it has today reached a heightened state of emergency. This is due to a number of factors. First, the very essence of marriage is compromise, creating a fusion of one's identity with one's spouse. Since there's a pronounced tendency to delay marriage to a later time in our lives, it becomes all the harder to compromise years and years of well-established patterns of living and private likes and dislikes. With age, we tend to become more rigid and only look for a mate that will be an exact fit. That narrows an already limited group of possible marriage partners even further. I recently read about a case of a young couple who were experiencing serious strain in their marriage. "The problem with our marriage," the husband told the marriage counselor, "is that I roll and she squeezes." "She squeezes what?" the counselor asked. "The toothpaste." See, there's two ways to get the toothpaste out of the tube. Some people just squeeze, and others are very careful and roll it up. Well, I'm very careful and she's not. Of course, the advice of this later date Solomon was to get two tubes of toothpaste. This may be only apocryphal, but it illustrates a difficulty one experiences in changing the set patterns of a lifetime. Secondly, our ideas of what a proper mate should be is shaped not only by common sense and tradition, but also by a plethora of romantic novels, thousands and thousands of TV shows and movies, and hundreds of magazine articles. The search for the spouse that will live up to the expectations created by the media reminds me of the story of the man who was looking for the perfect girl. For years and years, he searched and searched, and finally he found her. The problem was, unfortunately, she was looking for the perfect man. Of course, this is not always so. There's the story of a husband and wife who were constantly arguing. Despite her many fine qualities, this wife's level of housekeeping was far below her husband's exacting standards, and it bothered him to no end. "The problem with you," the husband said one day, is that I'm a perfectionist and you're not. That's right, she replied. That's why you, the perfectionist, married me. And that's why I, the non-perfectionist, was willing to settle for you. Kidding aside, the qualities in a mate that will create a happy and long-lasting marriage are not necessarily the qualities presented by the media. A third reason is that for many young people today, marriage is not considered a primary goal. Marriage often gets in the way of the more important personal goals of continuing education and career advancement. Also, with a nearly 50% failure rate, marriage has increasingly become more scary and less appealing. It was probably one of those failed marriages that inspired the following story. Two old classmates met after some years. "Are you married?" one asked the other. "Nah, I only look that way. Someone just stole my car." In addition, increasingly liberal societal standards have enabled many to experience many of the pleasures of intimate living without the burden of commitment, responsibility, and children. As a result, many young people often delay marriage indefinitely. Under these circumstances, it becomes harder and harder to find serious people willing to make the lifetime commitment that marriage entails. And finally, for most people, the present system of finding a shidduch, a fitting marriage partner, is hopelessly inefficient. In days gone by, the matchmaking process was a family affair. Through a far-reaching network of their family and friends, and through the help of professional shadchanim, professional matchmakers, parents were able to receive a wealth of critical information about suitable matches from areas far beyond their own locale. This system, by the way, is still employed in the Hasidic and yeshiva communities. The role of parents wasn't limited to just information gathering. Parents, not caught up in the emotions of physical attraction and fantasy, were also able to help their children make more rational and objective marital decisions. Many are the stories and jokes that are associated with these family-arranged shidduchim. One of my favorites is the one where the father of two girls from a certain city independently met with a Rosh Yeshiva, the head of a large rabbinical seminary, asking for his help in finding the right match for their girls. He didn't respond to the father's request immediately, but after giving it careful thought, the Rosh Yeshiva approached two young men, one whom he felt would be right for one family, and the other who would be right for the other. After speaking at length with the young men, it was decided that at the end of the term of the yeshiva, these young men, these yeshiva bochrim, would visit the city where these girls resided and meet the respective girls and their family. The day finally arrived. Both young men were scheduled to leave together on the same train. Then the problems began. Although the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the rabbinical seminary, wrote to both families about the scheduled date, he failed to tell them the names of the young men that would be coming. On that scheduled day of departure, at the last minute, one of the young men took unexpectedly ill and was unable to go. In fact, he was so sick that he was unable to leave his bed to telegraph ahead that he wouldn't be coming. The other young man who did arrive had lost a slip of paper with the name of the family that was expecting him. You can imagine the sight. At the train station were two families, husband and wife, eagerly awaiting the train. To their dismay, only one yeshiva student stepped off. After a few minutes of heated discussion, it became clear that no one knew what to do. In desperation, one of the fathers grabbed the young man's right arm and said, "He's mine. I'm taking him home with me to see my daughter." "Oh, no, you don't," said the other father as he grabbed the young man by his left arm. This one pulled this way, and the other one pulled the other way. Amidst the screams and cries, someone in the crowd yelled out, Let the rabbi settle this. With that, both fathers, securely holding the yeshiva bocher in hand, took him to the city's chief rabbi to reach some kind of settlement. After hearing the details of this most bizarre affair and the claims and counterclaims, the perplexed rabbi just sat there stroking his beard, deeply absorbed in thought. How was he ever going to decide who were the true prospective in-laws and who were not? After what seemed to be an eternity, the rabbi, like King Solomon of old, finally issued his decision. There's only one way to settle this. We must call the town butcher and split this young man in two. You, pointing to one family, will take one half, the half you're holding, and you, pointing to the other family, will take the other half. No, no, screamed the mother of one of the girls. You can't do that. That's murder. Let the other family take all of him. No, no, screamed the other mother. The decision is fair. Split him in half. With that, the rabbi looked squarely at the last speaker and pointed his finger. That woman, she's the true mother-in-law. But for most people today, meeting a suitable mate is a rather hit and miss affair, confined primarily to the workplace or its social functions. Parents have little, if any, input, and one's own network of acquaintances is often extremely limited. In light of all the difficulties mentioned above, it is truly a miracle that anyone ever gets married. But as we stated above, God himself takes a special interest in the matchmaking process. How God does this all, and how we can help the process along and make sure that our soulmates stay with us throughout our lives, is the topic of tonight's lecture. As you've noticed in the handout, we've divided this lecture into 12 sections. And my wife has reminded me to keep them all short. Okay. The first, and it spells out, by the way, the acronym, Find Your Mate. The F of find is fate. The Talmud teaches us, and this is the first citation on page 2, that before a child is born, actually at the time of conception, there is an announcement. This 40 days before the creation of a child, according to Jewish law, a child that's 40 days old, the fetus that's 40 days old, is considered a viable being. Those are the laws of abortion, you know, apply then. 40 days before means the time of really conception. And at that time, that point, a person's life is mapped out. And there's an announcement that goes out. And this is the basco, you see in the English, really it's the echo. And the daughter of A is for B, the house of C is for D, the field of E is for F. The person's life is mapped out. It seems that this mapping out, though, happens in two distinct ways. The title of this lecture is How to Find and Keep a Soulmate. According to the Kabbalistic tradition, there is a thing called a soulmate. That is, if we are created, as really two halves. And every person has his complement. That's one form of what's basher, what was set for a person at the time of conception. We've discussed in previous lectures, though, the idea of reincarnation. That, again, part of the Kabbalistic tradition is that this is not necessarily the first time we are here on Earth. And if so, it's not necessarily so that our original soulmate is coming down with us. But our life, nonetheless, is mapped out. Because for whatever we need in this incarnation, for whatever we need to improve ourselves, there's somebody out there who's been set up as the person to be with us throughout life. It perhaps is not the original soulmate, but it is, at least in this incarnation, the soulmate. That's the first approach, what was originally set for the person at the time of conception. The Talmud, though, speaks of another mate, not the original one. And this is called the Zivug Sheni, the second one. For whatever reason, according to most commentaries, the first one didn't work out. There was a death in the family, there was divorce. God doesn't leave this person alone. The man or the woman, he's constantly involved in finding the right person at this juncture of their life. However, the considerations, though, when a person is an adult, is different than one is just a fetus. Because what's right for a person after he's accumulated so much knowledge, so many experiences that have affected him both positively and negatively, it's important for his growth to have a certain kind of a mate. And the mate at that point is not necessarily the perfect fit. And here we have, and I'd like to read, this is on the second line of the English translation of F. They only pair a woman with a man according to his deeds. And it works vice versa, according to her deeds as well. The pairing is dependent on what do you need at this juncture of your life. Because, and this is a theme that we've repeated again and again throughout these lectures, the purpose of our being here, what are we here on earth, is to change ourselves, to transform ourselves. We were originally given a soulmate, but not all mates are soulmates. Sometimes we lose them. But God's still involved in the process. And at this juncture, it's not an easy process. If you notice on the fourth line of the English translation, it's as difficult to pair them as was the division of the Red Sea. It's a minor miracle. As if you're putting a square peg in a round hole. It's not an easy fit. So the first thing to keep in mind, the F of find, is God is involved. And that's fate. He's involved at conception. He's involved late in adult life. The I of find is inspiration. And inspiration is understood on two levels. As we said, God is involved, but we have to invite him in. And that's the idea of prayer. Prayer is inviting God to be part of our lives. That's really the dynamic. The person asks, what is prayer? What's prayer all about? Prayer is inviting God. And in this we have the citation. Again, the I is that everyone should pray for the purpose of finding a wife. Because even though there's somebody ideal out there for you, if you don't ask, you don't get. If you want God to be involved in the process, you have to invite him in. You know, it is said, the Talmud makes the point about God's involvement in marriage. It's been said by a famous rabbi that the involvement that God has in marriage is often more obvious than it is in other areas of our life. And I'd like to read to you the following story. And everyone has their own story. This is taken from the book Two Halves of a Whole by Rabbi Yirmiyahu and Tehillah Abramov. And again, it's possible that the names have been changed here, but the important thing is the story. Reuven Schwartz was a successful diamond dealer in his mid-30s. He enjoyed traveling, meeting people, making connections. When he wasn't on the road, he lived in the midst of a thriving Jewish community in New York. His sister and her family lived close by, and numerous other relatives lived within the city. But despite his own and their efforts to find him a suitable mate, he was still a bachelor. He was on a Tuesday night flight, anxiously anticipating his return to New York in time for the Jewish New Year that Wednesday night. He just spent 4 productive days in Bangkok, the tail end of a month-long business trip in the Far East. Flight 081 would arrive in New York the following morning, just in time for Erev Rosh Hashanah, the eve of Rosh Hashanah. Exhausted from his heavy schedule, Reuven boarded the plane, settled into his seat, and relaxed while his fellow passengers continued to organize themselves for takeoff. He did not notice the worried-looking official approaching his seat. "Excuse me, sir, are you Mr. Schwartz?" Reuven opened his eyes. "Yes." A short, stout man in a flight uniform stood in the aisle looking right at him. "I'm sorry, sir, but our computer has just spotted a discrepancy. Your ticket is invalid. You'll have to come with me." Ruvain's drowsiness vanished. "What? That's impossible. I've been using that ticket all month." "I'm sorry, sir, but the last stub for this flight is missing. I'm sure it's just an oversight, but we have to follow regulations." Reuven was aghast. "I'll have to buy a new ticket. This is the last flight to New York, and I have to be on it." Nearby passengers sympathetically looked on. One man leaned over and offered to help. The clerk just shook his head. "Please, sir, there's no time to write up a new ticket. The plane is almost done refueling. You must get off this plane and come to me, to our office." Traveling on a tight schedule close to Jewish holiday had always worried Reuven, but in 15 years, nothing like this had ever happened to him. "What's going on?" he thought. "There's nothing wrong with my ticket. This is impossible. I can't stay in Bangkok for Rosh Hashanah." The clerk refused to budge without Reuven, but at the office, there was no way to straighten things out in time, and his flight left without him. A call to New York just a few minutes later confirmed that the oversight had been a simple numerical error. His travel agent had made a small mistake, causing Reuven to be stranded in Bangkok on Erev Rosh Hashanah. Still in the airline's office, Reuven thought rapidly. From a conversation he had earlier that week, he knew that scarcely any of the observant Jews in Bangkok remained there for the High Holy Days. Most arranged to be in Europe at that time, so he did not have many options available. "Are there any flights to Hong Kong?" he asked. Fortunately, there was one scheduled for the morning. Hong Kong was the nearest city with a Jewish community that he could join for Rosh Hashanah. Reuven finally arrived in Hong Kong completely drained. He made several inquiring phone calls from the airport and was very happy when a Mrs. Fisher invited him to spend the holiday with her family. What a relief not to have to stay in a hotel again, thought Reuven when the taxi dropped him off at the Fisher home. Reuven could not help but wonder at the strange turn of events that had him celebrating Rosh Hashanah in Hong Kong. After 3 days as a guest with the Fisher family, Reuven had a clear understanding of why events had worked in this mysterious way. Joining the warm family for all the Yom Tov meals, Reuven had become acquainted with the Fisher's eldest daughter, Sarah. Reuven did not leave Hong Kong in a hurry. Instead, he checked into a nearby hotel after Rosh Hashanah. He and Sarah needed more time to get to know each other. 25 years later, Reuven still jokes with Sarah about the travel agent who made the, quote, mistake with his ticket. "To our good fortune," he says with a wink at his wife. So again, F is fate. I is inspiration. We ask for inspiration to find the right mate. But inspiration has a different connotation. And that really comes, this is on page 3. And this quote is a classic. It's on paragraph C. We'll read this together. Rabbi Akiva expounded, when husband and wife are worthy, the Shekhinah abides with them. But when they are not worthy, fire consumes them. Rava said, the fire which results from the woman is severer than that from the man, as the woman is more sensitive to this lack of spirituality. So, in other words, a marriage could be a place where the divine presence rests. It's a place of joy, of inspiration. It could also be the place of an all-consuming fire. The worthiness depends if you ask God to join the marriage. If God's not there, all you have, according to the Talmud, is fire. The next part is N. So F is fate, I is inspiration. Now you've prayed, you have this sense that you want God to lead you. What's the next step? The Torah tells us the story of how Abraham Avram, when he was looking for the right mate for his son Yitzchak, Isaac, told his servant to go, and this is the end, is on page 3, to go unto my country, to my kindred, and take a wife unto my son Isaac. There are tremendous adjustments involved in a marriage. You want to up the odds, so to speak, and to create as much commonality between the two as you can. If at all possible, you should take a person from the same background, from the same country. You laugh at the same jokes. You can recall the same shows, books, experiences. And this is the other quote is, fortune is the person, as the Medrash Mishlei, whose wife is from his own city. The greatest diamonds may be in your own backyard. Next is D, which you have is desire. Desire or chemistry or attraction are a principal ingredient in a successful marriage. But the role of this attraction is more of a catalyst than that which defines the relationship. The Talmud, meaning here, this is in the bottom of page 3, this is a more Kedushin in Mem Aleph Amud Aleph from 41a, looks to attraction and physical desire as something that will keep the marriage together. The person is not turned off by the other party. But that doesn't constitute the essence of the marriage. As you say, the essence of a marriage, as we're going to continue on, is a spiritual essence. Unfortunately, the message we get from the media is very often that people are toys. They're consumables. You go into a marriage because it's fun to be with the other person. I don't know how you do it, but when my children were younger, I used to let them steal the Afikoman. I don't have the patience for it anymore. They're older anyway. And I had a very poor track record of finding the Afikoman after they hit it. So inevitably, after Yom Tov was over, I took the yearly trip, the pilgrimage to Toys R Us. And I went down the aisles to look for the ideal toy. And first we went through aisle A. Ooh, this one, I got it. Oh, good, take it. We got to aisle B. Forget that one, I want this one. You only allowed one toy now. And that's how it went throughout the whole store. Finally, paid for the toy, brought it home. In 2 weeks, it was in a discard box, never to be played again. Toys have limited shelf lives. To a large degree, the feminist movement was created as a reaction to this view, that mates are just toys. I guess the best analogy to the idea of the role of beauty in a marriage, or attraction, or this chen, this grace that the Talmud speaks of, this special gift that's granted a husband to a wife, that they feel this special attraction and grace. An article I recently read in the Wall Street Journal, this is written by Amy Gamerman, that there was an Italian opera star who was booked to sing across the country and had this terrible fear of flying. So she bought this Rolls Royce. It was a top-of-the-line car. And Amy Gamerman described how she went in for a test drive and how comfortable it was and how plush it was. And the TV in the back seats and the champagne. It was just wonderful. Imagine, if you will, two driveways. One has a Rolls Royce, this exquisite car. And the other has a Chevrolet, a Toyota. The difference between these two cars is the Rolls Royce can't leave the driveway. It has no engine. I mean, it's plush and it's beautiful, and you could go in and you can turn on the radio and the stereo system is superb, but it doesn't drive. The other one, despite all its failings in creature comforts, gets you from point A to point B. You would obviously say that the beauty really is not important. The importance of a car is its drivability. Beauty is secondary. And that probably is the Jewish definition of marriage. I'd like to add one caveat, though. The Talmud speaks about the importance of clothing. And clothing in marriage. And the attraction of clothing in marriage. And we find that clothing has three distinct functions. We find clothing to escape the uncomfortability, the shame of going without clothes. And this is the story of Adam and Chava and Adam and Eve. We find the utilitarian function of clothing. It keeps you warm or it protects from heat. And we find a third function of clothing that adds prestige to the person who wears the clothes. If you go to a shul and you see the Sefer Torah, you see the scroll, it's always clothed. It's not for the first two reasons. It's because clothing adds to the esteem, the prestige of that which it's surrounding. And in a certain sense, every human being, every Jew, is a living Sefer Torah. We all have a soul. We'll have tremendous capability of spirituality. The kind of clothes we wear, though, communicates a certain message of what kind of people we are. There are clothes that communicate the message that we are a Sefer Torah. We look dignified. Brings out the best in us. There are clothes that we wear that suggests that we're just an advanced ape. There's unfortunately a tendency for people, and of course the industry that creates this, and the advertising industry, and all the thousands of people who make a wonderful living from this, that the consumer buy clothing that creates this animal attraction with anyone who's on the street, in the mall, in the office place that looks at them. It's a wonderful thing, perhaps, in a bedroom, in a home. Outside, though, the image that you want to project is the image that you truly are. We're all Sifrei Torah. We're all spiritual beings. And it's just very ironic. And this, by the way, is the Torah's view of clothing. It's just very ironic that very often people outside their homes dress to kill. Inside their house, they look like schlumps. In other words, and again, we're speaking about desire, the place for desire, and to cultivate that desire, and the close relationship with a husband and wife, of course, is the home. It creates a certain special relationship between the husband and the wife. But outside the home, especially if a person's married already, it's a different message that you want to project. I want to be respected because I'm a soul, because I'm intelligent. This is just a little far afield, but I think it goes really into the general definition of what marriage is all about, what we're all about. And again, speaking about to try to find a soulmate, it's important for us to view ourselves as souls. So the first, again, find is F, fate. God's involved in this process. I, inspiration. We seek inspiration. We want God to be part of it. We invite God to be part of our lives and part of our home. We start the search nearby to try to find people that have the closest affinity to us. And we do try to find people where there is a element of desire. Not that it defines the relationship, but it's a catalyst to foster and cultivate that relationship. Why, this is the next one, is your. And the why is your needs. Now, what kind of a person, we've gotten so far here, we've decided that I'm going to look for a soulmate. I've asked God involved. I'm looking around. What kind of a person? What's the inside of that person? What kind of a person am I looking for? The definition of a marriage is a relationship of mutual responsibility. Before the marriage ceremony, the husband willfully engages himself into the marital contract called the kesubah, the ketubah. I don't know if you've ever read it. One of the chief lines there is Ano afalach ve'oikir ve'ezoin ve'afarnes yisichi lichi. And I, the husband says, will work, will honor, will provide food and other needs for you. That's the essence of what a marriage is. I once heard a beautiful metaphor to describe heaven and purgatory. One went and saw, this is only an analogy, it's only a story. A person went to the other place, to purgatory, and he saw a beautiful meal on long tables. And the people sitting by the table were emaciated, couldn't eat. And the problem was that the forks that they had were 3 feet long. They couldn't get to their, there was no way for them to get to their plate. So they had all this wonderful food and couldn't eat. Then a person was shown heaven, Gan Eden. Same sight, beautiful table, sumptuous meal, and everyone was eating with 3 foot forks. What they did was that everyone fed his neighbor. That's heaven. That's a true marriage. Those in the other place, they're busy feeding themselves. It's not very satisfying. But when one is involved in feeding the other person, one is automatically fed in turn. There are exceptions in terms of the responsibility that a husband has, which is a contractual responsibility to go out and work and to provide a living. One case, of course, is a student going through medical school. It's impossible for the student to continue his studies while at the same time providing enough of an income to support a wife. Another exception is a kollel. This is an advanced rabbinical school where rabbis who've studied many, many years are continuing their studies for generally for a limited amount of time, enabling them to achieve positions in the rabbinate, professorial positions in yeshivas. These are exceptions and for the most part very temporary. But on the whole, there is mutual responsibility. What's very interesting, and this is a point which we're going to bring out a little later as well, the difference between men and women is indicated by the relationship of responsibilities. A woman does not need a kesuba, does not need a contract to make her be involved in her husband's life. It's natural for the woman. Those feelings come natural, that she'd be constantly involved in helping and improving. For the man, it has to be legislated. It has to be involved in it. And it's in a very important, as we're going to get back to this, because it is really it's very indicative of the difference between the natures of men and women. We speak of love. It's one of the most sacred words in the English language. It's also very confusing. This is a point that I brought up in a class last year. We say, I love my parents, love my grandparents, love my children, and I love fried chicken, and I love pizza and vanilla ice cream. Very confusing. One is the love of giving, of care, of concern, and the other is love that you love yourself. Very often when we speak about love in a marriage, it's the fried chicken variety rather than the parent or child variety. The Hebrew word for love is ahava, which the commentators explain is related to the Aramaic word hav, which means give. There's a beautiful story about what true love is. One of the great saints of the last generation was Rav Arya Levin. One could speak hours and hours about this person. On his own, he volunteered to be the chaplain in the prisons that held the Jewish freedom fighters during the Mandate. And on his own, he relayed messages from the underground to these prisoners. His kindness knew no bounds. One time his wife had a problem with her foot, and they went together to the doctor. And the rabbi explained the problem, and he says, "Doctor, my wife's foot hurts us." That concern that her hurt affected him is really what Jewish love is all about. When you're entering, you're looking for a mate. You want this soulmate. The quality that you want to find in that mate is the quality of giving, the quality of responsibility. The O of your is outrage. And as we quote from the Gemara in Sota 3b, you know, it's on top of page 5, anger destroys a marriage. One of the principal ingredients of a successful marriage is infinite patience. Because after all, you're dealing with a person whose views and likes and dislikes are different. When you're looking for a soulmate, one of the chief areas to look out for is how patient is this person? Does the person express their outrage? So the O, again, this of your is outrage. The U is unselfish. Not only in a marriage are we required to take care of the partner, and again, this is the analogy of the long, the 3-foot forks, but we're also required to put our spouses and children's concerns before us. And this we have here, quoted on page 5. Person should honor his wife and children, take care of their needs more than his means allow, is to go beyond himself, for they are dependent upon him, and he is dependent upon he who spoke and the world came into being. He's dependent on God. They look to him, he has to provide for them. And if he's found wanting, let him pray. But his responsibility is first and foremost to them. And again, it has to be legislated for a man. For a woman, it comes natural. You don't have to tell a woman to legislate a woman to put her children or her husband's before herself. A man, these things don't come naturally. This is the way he was designed. It's a lot harder for him. The R is respect. We spoke about responsibility. The Y is your needs. The O, outrage, having patience. The U, the being unselfish, in fact, going beyond and putting the needs of the spouse beyond your own needs. The R is, probably one of, if not the most important ingredients in a marriage is respect. And as the Mishnah in the beginning of the fourth chapter of Avos explains, Ezehu mechubod hamechabed es habrios. Who is the person who is honored is the one who honors others. Respect begets respect. You respect someone, they naturally respect you back. And when you put down someone, perhaps because of your impatience, perhaps because you don't have the discernment to realize the wonderful qualities that each and every human being has, it only begets the same kind of reaction. This is the ash, this is the fire that burns up a marriage. I was once sitting at a dinner, and I had the privilege of hearing Rav Lazer Levine. He was the equivalent of the chief Orthodox rabbi of this community. And he explained a verse in the beginning of the book of Exodus, Sefer Shmos. I believe is defined his own character. Those are privileged to know him. But I believe is an important lesson for us all. There's a story there that Moses originally was reluctant in accepting the mantle of leadership to guide the Jewish people and take them out of Egypt. And he said, he expressed his fears to God. And he said, well, they won't believe me. They won't trust me. And God, Hashem, says, what's in your hand? He says, it's a matah. It's a staff. He says, throw it on the ground. He threw it on the ground. It turned into a snake. And instinctually, says Moshe, Moses recoiled backwards. And then God told him, says, take hold of it. He took hold of that snake, and it turned back into the staff. Rav Levine explained, a staff, there are many different words which denote a stick in Hebrew. A walking stick is a kona. A stick that's used as a form of punishment is a shevet. And the stick, which is a cane, which is a sign of dignity and nobility, is a mata. You take a person, which is symbolized by this dignity, and you throw him on the ground. He becomes a snake. A vertashlam. He becomes a snake. You lift that person up, and he comes back to his former self. He becomes that symbol of nobility. If you treat a person with nobility, they are noble. And it's not irretrievable. Even after having mistreated a person, putting a person down, it's not too late. You can still lift that person up and convert that person, what seemed to be a snake, into what truly that person is this noble entity, this staff. So again, when you're looking for a mate, it isn't just, again, we discussed desire. Is there an attraction there? It's an important catalyst. But more important, does that person have these spiritual qualities of responsibility, of patience, of altruism, and respect? So again, this is how to find the soulmate, is you have to know what to look for. And now we get to the last section, mate. As we said before, there are various differences between men and women. The key to a successful marriage is to appreciate those differences, understand them, and this is working from that backdrop to cultivate them. Men are men and women are women. They both merge as soulmates. Both have unique, special qualities, but they are different. In 1992, a book was published that became an overnight bestseller. The advice contained in that book has helped countless couples to achieve greater understanding and more loving and fulfilling relations. The name of that book is Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. The name of the author is Dr. John Gray. In the author's words, and this is taken from page 5 in the introduction, Not only do men and women communicate differently, but they think, feel, perceive, react, respond, love, need, and appreciate differently. They almost seem to be from different planets, speaking different languages, and needing different nourishment. He goes on to explain that men value power, competency, efficiency, and achievement. They are always doing things to prove themselves and develop their power and skills. A man's sense of self is defined through ability to achieve results. Women have a different set of values. They value love, communication, beauty, and relationships. They spend a lot of time supporting, helping, and nurturing one another. Their sense of self is defined through their feelings and the quality of their relationships. And they experience fulfillment through sharing and relating. Instead of being goal-oriented, women are relationship-oriented. They are more concerned with expressing their goodness, love, and caring. This is taken from pages 16 to 19. Their role in a marriage reflects this reality. Again, to quote the author, this is from page 43. Men are motivated and empowered when they feel needed. When a man does not feel need in a relationship, he gradually becomes passive and less energized. With each passing day, he has less to give the relationship. On the other hand, when he feels trusted to do his best to fulfill her needs and is appreciated for his efforts, he is empowered and has more to give. Women are motivated and empowered when they feel cherished. When a woman does not feel cherished in a relationship, she gradually becomes compulsively responsible and exhausted from giving too much. On the other hand, when she feels cared for and respected, she is fulfilled and has more to give as well. And again, from the author on page 133, men primarily need trust, acceptance, appreciation, admiration, approval, and encouragement. Women primarily need caring, understanding, respect, devotion, validation of their emotions, and reassurance. I highly recommend this book, as it contains priceless information and insight into the dynamics of the male-female relationship. As a reaction to the abuse of women and the treatment of women as mere chattel, and with the increased role of women in society and positions of management, there's a trend today of social engineering, trying to redesign the basic nature of men and women so that it conform into an a priori unisex homogeneous entity. The last great attempt at social engineering, by the way, was the Communist Revolution. After millions of deaths and ruined lives, the heirs of that revolution, Russia and Eastern Europe, finally admitted that the revolution was a disastrous failure. It's refreshing to read a book that deals not with futile attempts to redesign mankind, but to deal with reality in such a positive and enlightening way. The book, again, as I said, has literally helped millions. The Talmudic view of marriage is based on this same reality. The very nature of a woman is to help. The Torah, as it introduces the woman, the creation, design of woman, she is called an Ezer, a help, a source of help. There was a change, though, in the roles of men and women after, as the Torah describes, their experience in the Garden of Eden. And the relationship is described by these few words, Vel Ishech Tishukosech. And God is addressing the first woman, to the man you have your desire. You want love. You want to feel cherished. Vuhu Yimshol Bo. But he shall rule over you. The man has to feel for for his own psychological well-being, that feeling of rulership. The woman has to feel, for her psychological well-being, to be loved and cared for and cherished. In fact, it's interesting how Maimonides, the Rambam, in the end of the 15th chapter of Hilchos Ishus, the Laws of Marriage, describes the difference between the relationship of respect that exists between a husband and a wife. And as we've quoted from the Talmud before, it says, a man is required to respect a woman, his wife, more than he respects himself, to care for her, to put her first. The woman, the Rambam explains, is required to look at her husband as if he would be a king. If both do their part, it's a marriage that both needs are fulfilled. And when people are fulfilled, they give in return. The Talmud here says this is on in letter M of mate, you know, masculinity. At the end of page 5, it's described about people whose lives are not lives. And one is the woman who rules over her husband. Rulership, of course, takes many forms. As Dr. Gray points out, the idea of nagging, of criticism, of the feeling that the husband is not needed, destroys a marriage. But the idea about a woman ruling over her husband is the source for the following story. The story is told about someone who died, went up to heaven, and the souls were being processed. They were being judged. And there were two lines. There were two desks of judges, and there were two lions. One lion, the new soul saw, he could see no end. It's like they say, it's as long as the Yiddish Agolus, you know, it's as long as the suffering of the Jews. There's no end in sight. And on the other line, see, there's one soul man waiting in that line. Couldn't understand what's happening. He turned to his angel guide and asked him, says, what are these two lines? He says, you see this line, this long one, you don't see the end? These are the husbands that their wives ruled over them. And you see that line over there? That's for the ones who ruled over their wives. He looked at this one guy standing in the line. He says, I've got to meet this guy. I'm going to have to see, who is he? As he gets closer and closer, he sees a short, sly Nebuch who's waiting in this line. And he goes over and he says, you know, excuse me, I don't want to offend you, but what are you doing in this line? And he looked back and says, I don't know myself. My wife told me to stand here. I'd like to relate, again, it follows the same reasoning here, the following story. A woman once came to the Ponovizhar Rav. The Ponovizhar Rav, he was the Rav Yosef Kahaneman, was one of the great Torah personalities, geniuses, saints of the last generation. He was the chief rabbi of the city of Ponovizh in Lithuania before World War II. And he went on to create one of the great yeshivas of the post-World War era in Bnei Brak. A woman once came to the Ponovizhar Rav crying bitterly about her husband's despicable behavior towards her. The Rav listened sympathetically. When his assistant, who had been present while she spoke, asked if he believed all those things the woman had been saying about her husband, the Rav said, certainly. Words spoken in truth are recognizable. But the Rav's assistant was genuinely mystified. How could this man, who had been known as a very decent fellow, lower himself to such behavior? He begged to understand. And so the Rav explained to him that when a man gets attacked at his most vulnerable point, his male ego, on a continuous basis, can only result in a tremendous deterioration in his behavior. This is a subconscious reaction to save himself from feeling as if all his power had been taken away from him. In these desperate attempts to defend his own honor, his logic can become totally crooked until he himself will not understand how could he have possibly stooped so low. The answer, said the Ponovizhirov, is for his wife to build him back up to the position of king in their home. This will prevent such situations from recurring, since then there will be no longer any reason for the husband to demand his own honor. A king can afford to be very kind-hearted, as he feels assured of his esteemed position and does not live in fear of being put down. And this really is, again, this is just describing reality. The Midrash quotes one wise woman's advice to her daughter upon her marriage. My daughter, stand before your husband and treat him like a king. If you will serve him as a maidservant, he will return that service to you and honor you as his queen. Or if you try to dominate him, he will master over you, then he will consider you as a lowly maidservant. One of the most sensitive areas that a male has is his sense of masculinity. It seems, again, from the Torah that this was created after the experience in the Garden of Eden. It reconfigured the relationship between male and female, but it is reality. And it's on that basis that a woman who wants to bring out the best in her husband and all the love and care and responsibility and respect that he has, that he truly has, and everyone has a desire to give, but has to create that sense of security in that husband. And again, this is the message of, this one of the major messages of men are from Mars, women are from Venus. The A of mate is awareness. Just as the man has this sensitive part that he has to feel masculine, the woman equally has sensitivities. And in fact, her sensitivities and her feelings are much more profound and much deeper than the man's. One of the major problems of failed marriages is that a man thinks on a totally different plane than a woman and can't understand those feelings. Because on his mind, it just doesn't make sense. The appreciation that feelings are feelings and they don't necessarily make sense. Not everything that we feel makes sense. But we have to appreciate that people are going through those feelings. And have an awareness and appreciation, again, is one of the keys, key ingredients in a successful marriage. We spoke about finding the soulmate. This goes into keeping the soulmate. Because people with wonderful qualities and much chemistry often find themselves in terrible situations when they fail to understand each other. A woman naturally offers help. That's part of her being. And another woman gladly accepts help from another woman. A man feels threatened. I mean, you can imagine, I'm sure this is a common scene. A man and a woman, a husband and a wife, are driving in a city and they are lost. The woman says, quick, let's go ask for directions. And the man says, no, no, I'll find my way. The woman can't understand, says, what's wrong with him? I'm only trying to help. What is he getting so defensive? Because, of course, she doesn't understand something which is not part of her own psyche, that he needs to feel in charge. And when a man comes home and a woman complains, you never talk to me, And he says, what do you mean? I spoke to you the day before yesterday. Again, it's indicative of people that are speaking and dealing on different levels. That's why, again, I strongly suggest reading the book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. It's a more, not the thing of finding the soulmate, but keeping that soulmate. I would like to deal with two ingredients that are not discussed in that book. And with that, I'll leave the floor open for questions. The T of mate is temple. As we said before, the divine presence rests in a Jewish marriage. God is in a Jewish home. But just as we have to invite him in to be involved in the process of finding that soulmate, we have to invite him in keeping him in our marriage as well. And I would like to speak very briefly about the notion of prayer. Because prayer is very, I mean, in society today, it's quite misunderstood. For most people, a home is not a place of prayer. It's a recreation center. You know, you work hard and you have to play. You have to relax. It's a place of R&R. You come home, you turn on the TV, you schmooze, you go here, you go there. It's a place to have a good time, you know. You're in the workforce and it's tough and there's a lot of frustration. And you come home to unwind and to have fun. But there's another dimension in a home, actually a Jewish home, and that's a dimension of spirituality. And it's so funny, and again, I don't know to what extent this actually exists, but the at least the stereotype, when you go to a religious or mildly religious Christian home, is when people eat, they say grace. Take a second. At least there's an acknowledgement that there's a thanks, there's an appreciation. You put God into your meal. I don't know how many Jewish homes say grace. You eat. Eating is having fun. You work hard, put a lot of effort into making it taste good. You want to enjoy the meal. You want to enjoy the company. There has to be a place. A home is also a temple. You have to invite God in. Another area is praying. You know, you go. We're familiar. We go walk into a shul, walk into a synagogue. It's very formal. You stand up. You say prayers. You sit down. You listen to a drosha, a sermon. How often do you see people crying in shul? Maybe yisker you see it. It's not very often. But crying, and especially for a woman who has that deeper sense of spirituality, is a key ingredient in prayer. The prototype of prayer, and how prayer is to be conducted, we learn from a woman, Hannah. She went into the temple, no one was there, and she was crying. Her lips were moving, there was no sound came out. It's hard to do that in a public setting. Unfortunately, for many, many reasons, many people have never learned how to pray beyond just mouthing words. But it's something that has to be cultivated and studied, and a home is the place for that kind of prayer. And finally, E is education. To change people from not just being advanced apes, but from being truly soulmates, you have to study. You have to bring the spiritual not just into your heart, but into your mind. And that's the role of education. Because after all, as we said, we are souls, and we're looking for soulmates. And we want a marriage to be not just the marriage of two animals, but the marriage of two souls. And that's why the study of Torah is so important in a Jewish home. That one truly becomes a soulmate. So again, let me just recap what we have, and then I'll open the floor to questions. We framed this class with the acronym Find Your Mate. F is fate. God is involved in the process. I is inspiration. We ask for inspiration. That's the role of prayer. We invite God into our own homes. We start the process N by looking nearby to find people with similar goals, with similar backgrounds. D, we look for people where there's desire, where there's chemistry. But more important, because we look at that as a catalyst for the marriage. The essential ingredient in a marriage is finding someone who has the qualities of responsibility to meet Y, your needs. O, can control the sense of one's outrage, has patience. U is unselfish, puts the other person before himself or herself. R is respect. M is masculinity, that the wife realizes the psychological makeup of a man. And A, that the man in turn has the awareness of the psychological needs and strengths of the woman. T, that the home has to be made into a temple. And E, it has to be made for a place of continuing education. And thank you. Oh. Yeah. If you have a question, you can step up to the microphone. Right.
And on the second marriage, I heard the second marriage goes after the Martin Tovim. The first is a divit and the second.
So right. Yeah. This is right. This was the point that we began. We actually began the lecture that there's a difference between the original mate, which is originally defined even before the person at the time of conception. That's the Zivug Rishon, the first mate. And the second, which has to be redefined. And that depends on one's maisim, one's deeds. This, where is one holding? Because again, the purpose, again, the marriage, we're thinking about soulmates, the purpose of marriage is to help one along one's evolutionary development. And it has to be patterned according to where the person in the second thing, where the person is holding at that stage in his life.
I think Ben Lander said that love is friendship that catches fire. Do you agree with it? It kind of implies that love is a gradual process and is very similar to friendship. In my experience, sometimes this kind of fire manages to burn up the friendship. So how do you go back from one to the other?
Right. There are really two, perhaps in this question, really perhaps two parts of the answer. One is that we quoted the Gemara, the Talmud before in Sota, in that the word for man in Hebrew is ish, aleph yud shin. The word for woman is isha, aleph shin hey. They both contain within them Aleph and Shin, which is Eish, fire in Hebrew. They also contain within themselves the Yud and the He, spelling God's name. To prevent the fire to be all-consuming, this is what the Talmud is saying, you have to put God in the relationship. That's one part of it. Otherwise, it says it's all-consuming. Just destructive. The second is, at least from a traditional Jewish notion of love, love is something which is cultivated over time. It is something which is created and cultivated through care and giving. Each one, each partner has a tremendous investment in the other. But one begins the marriage, at least in the traditional Jewish sense, it's not true love. It's the beginnings of love. It's infatuation. It's feelings. But love is something which, I guess like wine and cheese, become better with age. No question?
I don't believe in long courtships. You know, when you make a shit off, it's usually a contract made on the second or third day. And I was wondering if you believe in love at first sight, that if you meet the right person, I don't know you personally, but I know you personally, but I don't know in your relationship, if you knew the right person at the right time. In other words, should it take a long time to know if you'd be in the right thing?
Yeah, the question was, everyone heard the question, it's very well taken. You know, there's a saying, you know, different folks, different strokes. There are people, many of us, who don't feel the confidence going into a relationship unless they know that there is really a strong attraction there to begin with. Because after all, in a marriage, you're putting, each partner is putting their lives in the hands of the other person. They're totally vulnerable. And there's an awful lot of trust that's involved. For many people, I feel that they can't, unless they feel there's this spiritual, this chemistry, this feeling that this is the person who is going to actually have that relationship with me, they are reluctant to risk the possibility of trying to cultivate that relationship and fail. There are others, though, that rationally look at the person and says, the person is a fine person, has all the qualities that really make up what a marriage partner should be, and they have that confidence that those feelings will come. Our Bubbas and Zetas, our forefathers, generally went with the second route. And of course there are exceptions, but it seems generally, more often than not, it worked out very well. So it's a matter of confidence, of trust. The only problem is, which is really a problem of an ongoing thing, goes beyond the thing of marriage. That if a person's constantly living with fear, because maybe it's not going to work out and I shouldn't try this, a person ends up in life paralyzed and doing nothing. And if sometimes, right, if you feel rationally everything is here, it's quite warranted to make the leap of faith, so to speak. feeling that in all probability things will truly work out. Okay, I'd like to thank all of you. Just two.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.